This is Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. It's June 25th. I'm Sarah Reith, and we're at Grace Hudson Museum. Can you introduce yourself?
I am Michael Riddell. I came here in 1975 I bought my land in 75. I moved here officially solstice of 76.
Where did you move from, and why?
Well, I lived in San Francisco at the time. I just finished my teaching credential in 75 and was getting a divorce, and I owned a house down there and I sold it. I had custody of my two daughters, and we're 3.5 and 5 years old. So I moved up here as a single dad, and here I am a few years later.
So why Mendocino County?
By chance, I had gone to high school in Santa Rosa, very close by, and I knew the area a bit, but I'd never thought of moving here. And then in 75, some friends of mine who lived in the city, who had two girls about the same age as my girls, had turned off and dropped out. And it was a mind blower to me. So I came up to visit them on the solstice of 75. And I couldn't believe it. That was down there at the pond at the ranch house at Greenfield. And there were 400 naked hippies dancing around having a good time. And I was intensely working all these jobs in the city and finishing school and raising my kids. I said, I'm getting out. So I went back and sold my house. And it took me a year, but I finally made it up here. So,
what did you expect to find?
Well, the Back to the Land movement, as it was kind of quoted as, was something I'd grown up with my youth. Until I was about 6, I lived out in the country of Washington State. So I kind of liked the idea of living out in the country, and it was sort of a slight possibility we were going to be self-sufficient, which was kind of a fantasy, but a lot of people sort of believed in it. And as it turned out, we were somewhat self-sufficient, but it was a very short time before I was working in town. I had a job and doing things like that. So yeah, that was my first experience. Expectations are kind of unusual, because also in the late 60s, I was involved in the anti-war movement and the student movement. And I used to really preach against moving back to the land, stay in the city and fight the battle. That was the logo. The time, that was what we talked about a lot. So we wanted everybody to stay. And then here I found myself a few years later, get me out of here. I want to go to the country and relax. Mostly it was an unwinding. I had been living in so intensely, in the city, going to school and working and raising kids, that it was just a relief to get out to the country. So,
what were some of your first impressions?
Well, I liked the community. It was very nice because it was very supportive. I guess being a single dad, I got a lot of support, especially from the women sympathized with me. They would, poor guy, and help me out a little bit. Helped me out a lot sometimes. So my impression was that I liked the community. Greenfield Ranch particularly has a pretty tight community, and it was evolving at the time and growing. By 76, Greenfield had about 3 years of experience behind, people living there. And it was good. People helped each other out a lot. And that's what you miss when you live in the city. You can live 10 feet away from somebody in the city and not even know their name, really. So I appreciated that. And shortly after that, I fit into the community pretty quickly. And there we were. Everybody was doing that again. The other thing that happened was the pot scene, of course. We all hear about that extensively. I attempted to do that to some degree for the first few years, but I was never into it so enthusiastically, so I wasn't so successful. I made a little money to pay for taxes and Christmas presents for the kids sometimes, but that was about it.
What about interactions with people who were already here and were not Back to the Landers?
At first, that's interesting, because of a lot of the old-timers, we called them. They were the old, good old boys and things like that. And some of them were receptive, and mostly not. I mean, it's like with any of those damned hippies coming into the neighborhood, you know, and they're ruining our lives. It's like you can always accuse them of being the outsiders coming in, disrupting your place. I remember particularly George Butler, who was very accepting, and his wife, I can't think of her name right now, but they accepted us, and that was really, it was really pleasant to be around with them. They had the Butler Ranch, Butler Cherry Ranch, and that was a very, probably, we used to go up there and hang out, and they were, have these big dinners with a lot of the, you know, kids. We were all kids then, and we'd be 15, 20 of us hanging out there, bringing some food up, and they'd provide dinners, and we'd work on the ranch a bit, and it was fun. It was great. And as far as other older, the other generations go, some of the conservative people just, they were really, really down on us. I know, you know, some of the hardware stores, you'd go in there, and the old-time grape growers had, you know, they'd kind of, they wouldn't mistreat you, but it was definitely not friendly. You know, it's not as friendly as it could have been.
So what were some of the homesteading tasks that, I'm going to wait for that airplane to go over. So what were some of the first homesteading tasks that you set yourself to once you moved back onto, once you moved back onto the land?
Well, the first thing I had to do was build a house. And I had, before I had moved up there, I had torn down a pretty large chicken coop in Santa Rosa, recycled lumber. And by the time, from the day that I arrived on the solstice of 76 until I had a roof over my head was 44 days. So I just worked at it really hard, and, you know, I got, because I had to have a home for my kids. And so some of the neighbors came and helped a few times. There were, you know, projects like that. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a good time. It was summer, so it was, wasn't, and it wasn't a real extremely hot summer. So that was summer 76. Did pretty well. By the time, shortly after that, I had a roof over my head and plastic over the holes where the windows were going, and an old tin wood stove, but stayed warm, had a place to cook. Everything was secure. And then my immediate neighbors over the hill and I decided that we needed to have water. So we looked it up about, we got an Army Corps of Engineer manual, and we looked up ponds, how to build a pond. Well, first of all, we drilled a well. Waste of time, waste of money. And then we looked around at other options. We had some dowsers up about different places. And one dowser came up and said, water dowser, that is, you know, they do this. Well, he said, well, why don't you build a pond? So we looked it up. As I say, we got the Army Corps Engineer manual. And we looked it up how to do it. And we've done a rented a bulldozer. And between Dick Faxon and his wife, Marie, and myself, the three of us, we drove the bulldozer 22 hours a day for 14 days and built our first pond. It was the first pond on Greenfield. First, you know, real 3 acre feet of water held back. And it was a very well done pond, still exists today. And so we were the first ones. And then I called the state water resources and asked them about it. And they said, oh, you have to have a permit. So, okay, so let's, how much is the permit? Well, permit's $10. So, and we're sending two engineers out to make sure you get it done right. So two engineers came from Sacramento, and I paid the $10 fee. And there were other people at that time building ponds, so we decided to, a few people applied for permits. A year later, the pond permit fee went up to $100. And so that was, you know, kind of a big jump, but you can understand why, sending two engineers out. And shortly after, now there's about 50 ponds on Greenfield, and maybe 30 of them are permitted. Some of them did them without permits. But they're clamping down on that now, the pond holding back water. So,
what about Class K? Were you involved in any of the so-called code wars?
Oh, yes. I was very involved in it. Let's see. The building inspector at the time, gosh, I'm trying to remember his name, but he was a real good old boy. And he didn't... I, on Greenfield, I was on the building committee, and so we would go and see this, see him. His name will come to me when I don't need it, probably. But we discussed him. Now, what about using used materials, recycled materials? No, you can't do that. They have to be inspected. He was just down on everything we tried. And there wasn't a Class K quite yet. That hadn't come into be. Then it was clean slate, which was another option that you had for building. Means you could go back on a house that was already built, and they would inspect it and see if it passed the requirements that they needed, and then they'd sign you off. And you paid the building permit fees, et cetera, et cetera. And then Class K came in about the same time. So Class K was a statewide thing. Clean Slate was a Mendocino County thing. And so I worked with that, and I helped a lot of people in my neighborhood get through that process. And then one of the processes was, of course, the health issue was, how do you deal with your septic, you know, septic systems? And most people did that. A lot of people didn't. They just, they're still living with an outhouse and, you know, illegally. So, yeah, you know, so Class K was interesting. I built most of my houses Class K, even though I probably could have passed the Uniform Building Code with it, so.
Do you see any resemblance between Class K and the current attempts now in 2018 to permit cannabis grows?
Oh, that's a hard one. I'm not too familiar with the. I know that most of the people I know in that are involved with the cannabis grows complain because it's not user friendly at all. Class K was very user friendly. It was very easy to do. It was just. You would turn your plans into the county. The county would inspect them, and there are certain requirements. And then they would say, build it, and they'd say, do this, this, and this, change this or that, and then build it, and I'll come and look at it. So it was very simple. You know, you could, as long as your foundation was, you know, properly done, and they could visually see that, as long as the hand railings were properly done, and as long as the health department signed off on the health, that was all pretty straightforward. Now, the health department was a little pickier because they wanted to see it in different stages, and you know you had, and that was understandable because otherwise you could cheat in a lot of stuff easily or mistake. Making mistakes was easy. People who didn't understand the process could make a mistake and just totally mess up their whole system. So yeah, Class K was user friendly. I don't see this cannabis grow thing as user friendly at all. It seems like it's more of an obstacle that they're throwing out there, and I know quite a few people are just saying, I'm going to be a bandit and do what I want, you know, so that's an issue too, and I don't know where that's going.
So did you have any experiences in your upbringing or your education that prepared you for moving back to the land?
Well, as a matter of fact, my parents were high school sweethearts, and when they graduated, I can trace back when, you know, 9 months before I was born was graduation day. So when that was the Second World War, and so when they got, the war was over and they were back home, they were totally different people. And when I was born, my mother was only 18, so she turned me over to live with my grandmother. My grandmother and grandfather they were loggers, and they lived in the woods in Washington State. And so I grew up the first 6 years of my life literally living in the woods with an outhouse and a wash tub to take a bath in. And so it was kind of a familiar thing. And I didn't realize at the time when I was moving here that was really what I was probably seeking, a lot of that, you know. And I know a lot of people who grew up in the city and moved back here, and it was alien to them, kind of a different scene. But to me, it was very familiar.
So can you talk a little bit about raising your kids back to the land? You said you were a single dad, and how did you figure out education and keeping your kids safe and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, that's a good one. Well, I had two girls, 3.5 and 5, when I first moved here. And we didn't have TV or anything. And as I say, they learned to read very early and avidly read tons of books and had a great time. And about, I'm thinking, we had a school on Greenfield Ranch. So at that time, the school was very informal, and unfortunately there were some learning processes, but some of it not. I taught a little bit at the school, and every parent had a little responsibility. And I think it was in 77, the fall of 77, the school kind of started falling apart, and people weren't showing up on time, and the kids had an hour and 15 minute walk to get to school. And there were 12 kids in the neighborhood that all used to walk. I would never let them do it now because now we have lions and tigers and bears. At that time, there really weren't any bears or mountain lions around. But when Masonite started logging all that 5,000, 50,000 acres, whatever it was, they drove a lot of those animals in our direction. And so now we see mountain lions and bears quite often. But as the kids grew up, I decided to send them to Waldorf school. And so they, I got them involved in Waldorf, which they went through their first, whatever, 6 years, 5 years. And, you know, I felt that that was a little extra care for them. And I got married to my second wife in 81. So by then they were 9 and 10 years old, you know. And yeah, that was, it was a pretty good education for them. And then the one thing, they went to high school, they were very well prepared for high school. And but, you know, we didn't have TV, so they spent a lot of time reading, and we spent a lot of time talking, and I read out loud to them all the time. Whenever they did the dishes, we had stories to read, you know, so that was part of the process. So they did pretty well. And they both, my second daughter has a PhD, and my oldest daughter has a master's in nursing, and my baby daughter, who was born with my second wife, is a mountain ranger in the north, in Alaska, for the federal forest land. She's an outdoors girl. So.
And one of your daughters teaches building at the college, doesn't she?
Yes, my second daughter, Jen, she, I can't really take credit for training her a lot, but I did familiarize both the girls with hand tools and power tools, and somewhat they did some of that. And she got a job, let's see, she did work with me a little bit on some building projects, so did my oldest daughter. And she got a job with Wendy Jackson, I can't remember when, I think it was, she was still in school at the time, and on and off worked with Wendy, and Wendy trained her a lot of things, so she's a skilled carpenter, plus having her PhD in botany. So.
You mentioned previously that there are now mountain lions and bears on Greenfield, but I'm wondering if you had any interesting encounters with wildlife.
When I first moved there, I had not seen, the first time I saw bears was the time when they closed the Willits dump. They estimated there were 80 bears that lived in the dump. And some of those bears migrated down, and I put up a sign. I said, I'm willing to share, just don't break the branches. But they didn't read, see? So the bears would come in my orchard. I have about 40 fruit trees, and they would break the branches. So at first I was really angry about that, and I was ready to shoot them. And I called the Fish and Game, and Fish and Game sent a man up right then. He was there that same day, and he issued me a depredation permit, which was good for 30 days. He said, you have to shoot him with a rifle, not the shotgun. Okay, so I was getting ready to do that. And then one of my neighbors said, no, don't shoot the bears. News talk radio. You put a radio down on the orchard, and at 6 p.m., they up the amps quite a bit, and it sounds loud. And news talk radio has voices of two or three different people, like, arguing over things, you know, rah, 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 making a lot of noise. And it sure did work. I put it down there. I never had a bear problem after that, at least in the orchard. Now, since then, about 3 years ago, I had a bear get in and eat all my chickens. And I didn't know what it was at first. I didn't realize it was a bear, but he ripped all the boards off the bottom of the coop, got in and ate the chickens. So now I have an electric fence, and that works fine. It keeps the bears out, keeps the coyotes out. And we have foxes, coyotes. Foxes are tricky little, they're very foxy. They're a little tricky. So are the coyotes, they're very wily. The foxes used to come around and they would eat my raspberries. In about 5 or 6 in the afternoon, broad daylight, I can't believe it. There was this fox out there up on his hind legs picking the raspberries like a person and gobbling them down. So, and the other thing that was happening that time was we would miss, if you lay a pair of gloves down in the garden, one glove's gone. Or a pair of work shoes or something like that, one shoe is gone. So finally, yeah, I'm ready. This is it. I'm going to shoot that little bugger. And I got my gun out, and I got up to a good high spot, and here's the fox running across the orchard, and out to come two little kits with the gloves in their hand, gloves in their mouth, playing with them, you know, like little dogs. I said, that's not fair. I took a few shots around them, bang, 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 and it scared them off. And I didn't have them back for a long time. So that was my fox experience, although lately they've been coming back again, so. Foxes. And raccoons, of course, everybody has raccoon issues. But again, raccoon issues. So one day, this raccoon with three babies, right, three baby raccoons, I catch it on one of my apple trees, and I go, yell, get down here, you know, you guys get out of here. Leave the apples alone. So they all climb down from the tree, and they come very slowly, kind of walking. The mother's kind of looking, come on, let's go, God. Let's go, kids, come on. And then I have a small apple tree that was down there a little ways. And the mother goes over to the fence, and she's trying to get through the fence, and the three little ones crawl up the little tree. They're about this high off the ground. They're all hanging on like this, and I walk right up to them and say, you guys get out of here, you know. And they still come back again. Raccoons are persistent and very tricky. They've done some really tricky things to get some food, you know.
So you've mentioned that you have raspberries and an orchard and that you had chickens. Can you talk about ways that you figured out how to feed yourself on the ranch, or was it all going to the grocery store?
Well, the reality of it is you can work for your food and raise them. I've had a pretty substantial garden at different times and, you know, grown corn and squash and tomatoes and all the usual things plus. And it's a lot of work. And especially if you're working in town, especially if you're raising kids. So I do the easy things. The raspberries are fairly easy. The apples, I get, you know, pretty substantial apple crop. And I have an apple pressing party in the fall every year and make a lot of apple juice. I think we made 50 gallons of juice one year. And we usually get 100 quarts at least. So, you know, it's quite a bit. And then that's about it. I mean, we get tomatoes. The easy things are pretty standard. But I'll tell you the truth, it's so much easier just to go to the co-op and buy the nice organic food there and take it home, cook it up. Now that the kids are all grown and they're out of the house, it's just my wife and myself. It's, you know, even when we have the garden is not, it's just a lot of work. She likes to grow flowers and, you know, she grows kale and lettuce and things like that, which are pretty easy to grow also.
So you mentioned that you arrived at Greenfield on solstice, and I'm wondering if you could talk about special occasions or solstice parties at Greenfield.
Yes, typically at Greenfield there's three parties that were they're significant. The solstice, the summer solstice, and then the Halloween, and then the winter solstice party. So the winter solstice is typically combined with sort of a New Year's Eve, and a couple of the people have birthdays very close then, and so there's sort of this little gathering. It's usually pretty small for the winter one, but the Halloween party is usually big, pretty good. And we used to do it as a fundraiser for our roads. If you want to donate some money to the road, you can now. But our budget used to be, you know, $7,000-$8,000 a year. Now we're up to $50,000-$60,000 a year because it just costs more for everything so much nowadays. We pay for insurance. You know, we never used to pay insurance. You know, hippies don't pay insurance, you know. But now we pay insurance. And
do you have a particularly emblematic moment of any kind of special gathering that happened?
Oh, I suppose some of the Halloween parties. And yeah, some of the Halloween parties were the better. And in the early days, as I say, Greenfield was a lot of, we were all younger generations and a lot of single people. And there were a lot of incest, you might say, for the ranch. And so the parties were really good, and people would go all out to dress up and get some really great costumes. In those days, I remember one of the guys would come. He came with these, and it was unusual to have these lights that were portable, like you have Christmas lights that work from batteries. Very rare. That was a new innovation. And I remember one of the guys came with that. He was all lit up, and he was dancing, and everybody was just kind of, wow, that was amazing. Now, that's kind of common now. People, you know, have that kind of things with the lights. But yeah, those were the big ones. And then the summer solstice parties have always been good. And, you know, there's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Like, you know, great times. And now that we're all in our 60s and 70s, it's quite different. You know, it used to be a lot of fun to go down and look at all the naked hippies dancing around. Now it's kind of like, oh, look at those old people. It's still good. They're all good friends, you know, people that are nice.
So I know that psychedelics were a big part of the era, and I'm wondering if that played a role for you.
Very minor. You could go down to the pond in those days, and there would be Mushroom Julie and Acid David, and so, you know, the different people who had their supplies of whatever the drugs were at the time. But I was into smoking pot a little bit, you know, but a few times I did some acid. But it was not a real big focus to me. I guess it was, I had lived in the era of the, I was in the military in the early 60s, and then after that I got involved in the anti-war movement, and I was involved in Students for Democratic Society. Is that familiar? Yeah, okay, so it's, well, it's the radical student movement. And I got out of the military in 67, got involved in 68, and we were particularly not anti-drugs so much, but we didn't tolerate any of us having drugs because the cops would bust you and plant drugs on you. That was commonly known. And if you were known for not having drugs, it was very hard for them to do that. They couldn't say, yeah, we found all this stuff on them. Oh, no, they don't do drugs. So that was our movement. Yeah, and so we did that. And I still kind of held on to that a little bit. I wasn't so much into the drug scene. And I owned a house in the city. I was kind of living a semi-straight life, you know, pretty much. When I came to Greenfield, everybody was into the pot scene. That was a big deal. I mean, there were some big crops in those early days. I couldn't believe it. I was astounded at the money that was made. And yeah, hey, okay. I didn't get much of it, but.
What kind of work were you doing?
Oh, when I first started out up there, I installed carpets, helped install carpets for this one guy that was doing that on the ranch. Yeah, Mike Pallison. Oh, you know him too? Yeah, sure. Oh, I'm sure you do. So Michael, and I worked for Michael. I'd go around and do the preliminary work. A lot of times he'd just give me an address and say, put all the underlayment and the tack strip in, and I'd go there and have that all done for him, and he'd come put the carpet in. That was one of the jobs I did. And I did a lot of construction work, and then in 84, 85, I got my contractor's license, and I did construction for, 30 years pretty much with that. And I bought some houses in town, and I managed to hold on to them. And so I have a number of rentals in town, which is my retirement. So that was kind of my thing. It was good. And, all in all, Greenfield's interesting in different ways because you can see the professional type, or the people who wanted to pursue a career and did, they commuted to town, did their jobs, and there's still a number of people in the ranch that are still living the life of that hippie era thing where there was, it's hard to describe. It's not lazy, but just not motivated to be participating in the bigger society. Still very community-oriented, though. Almost everybody is up there.
Can you talk about how you organized yourselves as a community at Greenfield and how you made sure that roads were maintained and that there were rules and that people followed them?
That's an interesting story in itself, because when I first came to the ranch, it used to be first Sunday or last Sunday of the month was a general meeting. And anybody who showed up at the general meeting was on the board of directors for that week or that month. So decisions were made by the board, who happened to ever be there. And if something got decided one month, the next month the people who opposed it would come and vote against it. So nothing really got done too much. And I think it was about 84 or 5 like that, that it was about 10 of us that decided, let's have a real board of directors. So we went to the ranch house, and the way we elected a board of directors was you put your name in a can, and you drew your name out. And so we had 10 people's name in the can. We drew our names out. We're the board of directors. So we kind of took over the ranch, but we made things happen after that. We started collecting assessments, they were supposed to be collected anyway. We actually had to go to small claims court and take some of our neighbors to small claims court, which caused a lot of grumbling and rifts. But that's a whole nother story. I spoke to the judge on this. And we listened to 2 hours almost of the others opposing paying assessments. I spoke for 10 minutes. I told the judge, look, we can't do anything without money. This is the reality. These are the debts have to be paid. Pay the money or nothing gets done. Now, he ruled on our side, totally. But that was the organization then. And we have a road committee. We have several road committees and a road czar that kind of takes over leading the whole thing. And we get grading done. It's done mostly by neighborhoods nowadays. Each neighborhood has its own little road czar. And so that's our biggest expense. Would seem like roads, but I pay liability insurance, which is quite a bit. I think it's $6,000 a year or something like that. And we have board of directors insurance. I think those are the main two that we have. And then there's a pretty good, the main ranch house is common land. So there's 400 acres it's owned commonly. And we have to maintain that with special insurance, fire insurance, and there's maintenance on the ranch house and maintenance on the water systems and stuff like that. And that's maintained for common use.
So what about communication systems?
That's another issue. That's a whole, yeah, we started out, let's see, the 70s, the late 70s, the big thing was to get CBs. And we had a CB night. I don't know if it was every night. I think 8 o'clock at night, every night, people would turn on the CBs and talk back and forth if you could get somebody. If they're within range or anything. Where I was on the north side of the ranch, there were only about three people I could get. One of them was Leonard Lake. Have you heard that story? And no, the whole story, that's another half hour at least. Leonard Lake, sorry. Well, let me finish the communication thing first. So the communications went from CBs, and there was one phone line that came to the ranch house. There was a pay phone in the ranch house, and one other person on the way to the ranch house, they had a pay phone off that line. So in 84 or 85, I started doing research on what's it going to take to get some phones up here, lines up here. So I went to the phone company, and they said this thing, excuse me, the area that you're talking about is unincorporated, so we can't put phone lines there. Oh, okay. And then they said, well, and besides that, you're in the Redwood Valley area. You can't get a phone line from Morris Springs to Redwood Valley. I said, oh, okay. How about if I put a phone in at the ranch house? Oh, sure, you can do that. And then I said, okay, but there has to be somebody there. So we had to put the phone in at the caretaker's ranch. And then I put a 2.5 mile extension cord up to my house. Actually, variable. It wasn't just an extension cord, but there were five of us that went in on it. We put a phone line up there. And then other people around the ranch did it too. So on multiple occasions, I rented a ditch witch and a backhoe or different things, and we buried lines all over the place. And it was all this variable cable. So we had landlines in for a number of years. I found that every year, I had to go out at least once a year, maybe twice a year, and fix the line. And I got to the point where I knew where all the breaks were going to be. Animals bit them, chew them, a branch fell on it. And even though it was variable cable, burying that much cable through the woods, we got about 1/3 of it actually buried. The other thing was just laying on the ground. So that's why we had constant repairs. And then along came these phones that you could hold in your hand and talk on, the cell phone thing. And that was a whole new game. So now there's still a few landlines around. But then that was the issue then. So 3-4 years ago, Linda Gray on the other side of the ranch and I think a couple other people looked into these new radios that I don't know exactly if you call them. They're private frequency radio, and they'll work up to 10 miles or something like that. So there's about 60 of them on the ranch now. We can convince people to buy these mainly for fire safety. And when this fire happened last year, 2017 fire, they were really useful because our cell phones went down, the internet went down, and we still had these radios. I was on the very north edge of the ranch. I was the only one. I was the one reporting to everybody else that we were safe at this point. I can, it's not at my house yet, and when it gets to my house, I'm going to run for it. You guys better too. So we still have that radio system in, and that's been very effective. Besides our cell phones, when you have cell service. I learned that it wasn't always reliable cell service.
Do you get radio reception at Greenfield?
You mean just regular radio? Oh yeah, yeah, KZYX all the time. Yeah, get good radio service, and because I can see the Laughlin Peak visual from my place, and then we have an internet one of those line of sight radio thing or internet dishes, so we have good internet service at our house too.
So you were going to tell the lurid story about Leonard Lake.
I could tell it. I'll tell it in a brief story because it can get. I've recorded this on another recording one time just because there's so many details of it that are my first experience with Leonard Lake on the ranch was that he was kind of this straight guy with a crew cut and everybody's long haired and we're all kind of laid back. And an example would be in 1977, a girlfriend of mine at the time decided she was going to have a women's group and meet with the women where they could all talk about the feelings and stuff, you know? So the guys decided, and a couple of us decided, let's have a men's group. So we met. There were maybe 10 of us. I put a notice in the bulletin board. And about 10 of us got together, and Leonard Lake came. Kind of didn't expect him to show up. He sat down, and the first thing out of his mouth was, well, what kind of weapons should we carry, guys? Hey, man, this is, we're here to talk about feelings and stuff, you know? And, and he just couldn't get it. His how many women have you scored with up here? You know, it was just, he just wanted to be this big macho. So the next, I think we had a meeting every other week or something like that. For the next, we had about 8 meetings. And every single one of those meetings was totally focused on him because the things he would say, and then we would respond. It was like, today I made nerve gas. You made what? Nerve gas, yes, I have a formula for it. I killed 2 rats. I put on my gas mask and I killed 2 rats. Oh, geez, are you crazy? You could kill everybody on the ranch just playing around. Oh, no, no. If I was going to kill everybody on the ranch, I used my 45s. I've got 2 45s and 3 clips for each. I could have everybody down in about 2 hours, I think. And we're all just kind of stunned with our jaw dropping. He's thought this through. He has thought this through. And it progressed from there to the point where he sold his land, but he stayed on the ranch as a caretaker for the unicorns, which is a whole nother story in itself, the unicorn developing. And then the woman who owned that land caught him building his Miranda house. His Miranda house was based on a story that comes out of a movie in the early 60s called The Collector. It's a British movie about a British man who wins the lottery, and he is such an introvert, he can't relate to women, and he decides the way he's going to get women is he's going to kidnap them, put them in his dungeon of his new place, and convince them to love him. So her name was Miranda, the first woman he captured. So this was Leonard Lake's Miranda house. So Allison kicked him out of there. Don't ever come back here. And there were a lot of other incidences in the meantime that happened with that. So then he disappeared. In the meantime, while he was there, all these ripoffs were happening on Greenfield. People's chainsaws were getting stolen. People's cameras right off their kitchen table. Coin collections. People's just all kinds of things were being stolen from people, including their pot in a lot of cases. And so Leonard is gone for a number, about a year or two, or some period of time. And he rents this motel over in Anderson Valley. He rented it from Mike Shapiro. And he's still around. And he has stories about this too. And he told Mike Shapiro that he was looking for land. So Mike Shapiro was kind of helping out. So Ng, he connected with Ng through Soldier Fortune magazine, Charles Ng. And Charles Ng and he got together, and it turns out Charles Ng was stealing weapons from the Army. So the feds busted them. I don't remember what year it was, 82 or 83. And the feds came in with a major operation, 3 helicopters and guys jumping out of the thing and surrounding the place and come out with your hands up and the whole thing. And they arrested Ng and Leonard Lake. Ng was charged with stealing the weapons, and they didn't know about all this other stuff. He had not sold any of these chainsaws or things they'd stolen. They were all stashed in the motel in these different rooms. And so the sheriff's department took an inventory. This is all stolen merchandise. And in the meantime, Leonard Lake was charged with it. He disappeared. He had a bunch of cash that he had taken from when he sold his land. He bought this land, the land he owned in the Sierras. He bought it through his girlfriend's mother, had her buy it. And then he was kind of wanted as a fugitive at the time, not for murder, just for thieving, stealing things. And then before this happened, he brought his girlfriend up there. And her name was Cricket. And I thought she was a 12-year-old girl that he brought up. She looked like this, just this little, I don't know how to describe it, just she looked like a little girl, 12 years old. And he'd introduced her as his girlfriend. I was like, oh, God, what's he doing, man? Turns out she was in her 20s. And he also brought his brother up there, who I met, and his best friend from high school, both of whom he murdered. And when he went to the Sierras, he started this killing club that he and Charles Ng started. They would kidnap people from the city or entice them into a job, take them up there and kill them and videotape it. And it's unspeakable stuff that they did, and they videotaped it. The sheriff's department, when they finally did arrest him, didn't arrest him, but they arrested the Ng, they couldn't even watch the videos. They were just so gruesome and horrible. So the way they got caught was they were in the city making another run to collect someone. They were driving a stolen car from one of the people they'd killed, and he was using his credit card from this guy that he had killed. And Ng was in the store in a Goodman's, like a Freeman Brothers, but a Goodman's store, hardware. He stole a vice, and he came running out. He was a kleptomaniac. He came running out with his vice, and the store detective chased him out there, and then he dropped the vice and ran off. Meantime, Leonard Lake was sitting there. He arrested Leonard Lake. The police came, took Leonard Lake to the South San Francisco Police Department, took him in an interrogation room, and Leonard Lake used to brag when we were in a men's group, he always carried a cyanide capsule with him, just like James Bond. Nobody's ever going to take him alive. And he really did have one. He asked the police for a glass of water and a notepad, and he wrote a note to his mother, said, "Mom, please forgive me for all the things I've done. Leonard." Took the cyanide capsule and killed himself in the police station. In the meantime, Charles Ng escaped. They caught him in Canada because he was a kleptomaniac. He stole something and shot a department store guard, wounded him. He spent 7 years in prison in Canada. They didn't want to extradite him to California, but they finally did. And after a long period of time and trials, they finally executed him. You know, I'm opposed to capital punishment, but in some cases it just seems so appropriate. It's chilling. So that's the brief story of Leonard Lake. And he was our neighbor on Greenfield, and most everybody up there knows him or knew him at the time. So, yeah, chilling. There's a few other stories that are similar to that, but not as bad.
I wasn't aware that there were other folks aside from Leonard Lake and Jim Jones in this area.
Oh, well, yes. Charles Manson was up here for a while, not on Greenfield, but on Anderson Valley. He was up here with his family, quote unquote. There's a few things like that. The Hells Angels, I know a man who owns some property that used to belong to the Hells Angels. He's got 200 acres, and he said he's afraid to dig out there because he knows there were a lot of Hells Angels that disappeared or their enemies that disappeared. And the suspicion was that they were buried on the land he bought, so he's always avoided that, scared of that. And, you know, stuff happens. You know, these things happen. So I don't know what the Hells Angels did or how many places that happened, but I'm sure it was around here because it was somewhat of a rural area and it's easier to get away with things like that.
So you mentioned that Charles Manson was out here with his family, which is obviously not, his brothers and sisters. But if we could kind of edge away from the more psychotic levels and talk a little bit more about the relationships that people had and how you think they changed the culture and the way that people relate to each other.
Well, one interesting thing is I inherited on the ranch, I have a copy of the 1973 videotapes that were made by Haven Logan and her boyfriend at the time. And they interviewed most of the early people on Greenfield. And it was very interesting to see that almost all of those people interviewed had some goal in life, what they wanted to do. And Lynn Meadows wanted to do medicine and become a medical person. Her husband, Bob Dress, wanted to be a builder. Dennis Patton wanted to be a winemaker. These kinds of things. And there's about 15 people on there, including Kate. I've got videos of Kate in 73 and Bob Currier. And Bob was going to be a musician and he wanted to do all this. And Kate wanted to be involved in the Playhouse. And, these kinds of things. And most of those people went on to do those things. It's very impressive. They stayed with it and they contributed a lot to our community. And Greenfield contributed. You know, we Greenfield, people from Greenfield started the co-op. They started the community theater. McCavin was started by Greenfielders. Deborah Mead, she helped to start McCavin. And then the Playhouse was Kate and Bob Currier and Susan. And then the store was Lori. Actually, August Bullock, we called him Zing at the time, inherited some money from his family or something, like $10,000. At the time, seemed like a lot of money. And he invested in starting the co-op. He helped. It wasn't the original exact, but it was one of the motivators that got it going. And he used to work at the co-op when it was in a garage down there in Gobi Street, just this little tiny garage. And that was the first real co-op. And that was started from the Homestead Exchange, which was Darshan McGinnis and a few others that I don't remember all the names that they had gotten that together. Then it snowballed. It went over to the Perkins Street location and grew and grew. And now we've got a big co-op.
How do you think the Back to the Land movement affected the culture of Mendocino County?
I think it changed it dramatically. As my understanding of the history, the Native Americans that were living here, you know, was a very, very mellow area to live. There wasn't a lot of battles or war. And the people that first came here, there was a significant number of refugees from the Civil War. And so there was a hostility towards the natives, and that, you know, made it for the next 75 years was a pretty old school community of farmers and conservative peoples, rural conservatism. And when these city folk hippies came up here, they really bent the culture from that. And now we have like a 70% Democratic vote here, so pretty progressive, which is good.
How has the experience changed your life?
Well, it's, I think that people judge their experience in their lives, you know, looking, of course, now I look back on my life. Day before yesterday, I went to a memorial service for a friend of mine in Santa Rosa, and it was like, you know, meeting all these people that I hadn't seen in a long time, and everybody kind of reflects on their lives, and you look back on how your kids are, you know, are they doing things? Are they successful? Are they happy? And if they are, that really makes a difference. I feel very fortunate. My girls have just, they've done great. And I, you know, that's all I can judge it by. I say, they're doing good. What have I got? Well, I've got some years left, I hope. I like to go to Burning Man every year. That's my big event that's coming up. And, you know, I still like to do things and go to parties and stuff. As far as specifically how this area affected, I think it was, it's good, and it's hard to imagine our lives as being, this is it. Oh no, what's my next adventure going to be? I don't think I have too many more next adventures, you know. Some, but you know, not like big moves in my life. I'm not going to go start another family and live up in, you know, Alaska or anything. I fantasize about, oh man, it's so nice up there. Summertime it is. But my youngest daughter lives in a very remote area, 160 miles to the nearest grocery store. But she's got a good job, and she's got a fantastic job. It's only good for 7 months of the year, though. The rest of the time, she has to do other things. But I think that's what we're looking at, is how you look back on your life, how you appreciate the area. I think this has been a good area. And my girls all still come back here and still have connection with the kids they grew up with. And, you know, that may not be their focus in life. They might not hang with them all the time, but they're always pleased to come back and see their friends. And my oldest daughter, Gwen, in the Bay Area and in Santa Rosa where she lives, she hangs out with a group of people that all mostly came from Ukiah. There's mostly professionals, a couple of lawyers and social workers, things like that. You know, they're all, so yeah, they're doing good. And so that makes me feel like I've done okay. You know.
Are there any emblematic memories that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Emblematic. Yeah, it's funny. Back to the Land is, I mean, that is the definition of it, and that's what it is. And I've known Kate since, you know, way back. We've 40 years or so. And the last 10 or 12, 15 years that she's been doing this, telling the truth in a small town, And that's always interested me too, because I've gone to a few of those and listened to people's stories, some of the amazing stories that people have that you never ever would have thought of. And you know, how I always think of myself as being the storyteller. I don't think of myself as so much as the, you know, I had some great experiences. I had some great times, and really just I don't have any too many regrets. A few, you know, but it's depending on the audience. Sometimes, if it's some men, usually like to hear about Leonard Lake. They'll like to, you know, hear that story. Then there's a Medicine John story, which is a kind of a similar, somewhat, but not so violent. Some of the parties at the ranch house, sometimes those people like to hear about those. I'm blanking on some of them now, but I've recorded quite a few stories just because I realize I sometimes forget the details of them. So I've got a digital recorder that I've done it with. Yeah, it's generally I feel extremely fortunate to be here and have been around and seen and visually seen a lot of the things. I be thankful for that. So thank you.